All right. So there are some of us who today are really feeling our age. We started the show with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band because it is the 50th anniversary of the release of that record, that iconic record. If you haven't had a chance, read the New York Times piece on it. It's a wonderful story because, among other things, the Times reports on the fact that while Rolling Stone called it the greatest rock and roll record ever made, there were many critics who thought it was kind of bad. I just wanted to pay a quick tribute to Sgt. Pepper's and to my way-lost youth from far long ago. Dr. Andre Gillespie joins us today to talk politics, not music. I'm glad to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me.
Andre, she, of course, is a professor of political science at Emory University. Brian Robinson, Republican strategist, former communications director, deputy chief of staff to Governor Nathan Deal. Thanks for being here. Brian, it's great to see you.
Good afternoon, Bill.
You have no recollection of Sgt. Pepper's because you weren't even around when that record was released.
I wasn't, and I'm no spring chicken, Bill, yeah. if it makes you feel any worse.
And Greg Bluestein, the political reporter, one of the AJC's political reporters, is with us today. Hey, you've got some breaking news for us about Handel and Ossoff. Tell us what you've learned.
Yeah, we've just now heard that Karen Handel has agreed to four debates with John Ossoff between now and June 20th, which means a very, very busy schedule for us political reporters.
Do you know at this point what those debates are and where they're going to take place?
Yeah, the one that we already knew of was a June 6th debate with WSB.
Was already on the schedule. That was the one they'd accepted.
Yep. There'll be a June 8th one on WABE, PBA.
Okay.
There'll be a June 13th one with the Atlanta Press Club. And I guess CNN is going to simulcast it or be involved.
Yeah, well, CNN had the Press Club quite a while ago made a deal. CNN said they wanted to broadcast a debate. We've mentioned it on the show a couple times, and the Press Club decided they really wanted to be in partnership with them, which makes sense for the Press Club.
Exactly. And June 15th on WSB Radio. So there'll be four debates. It sounds like three of them will be televised. And nonstop fun,
okay,
starting with the WSB debate next Tuesday.
So this is this literally broke within the last 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know anything, or at least I certainly don't. But let me speculate for a moment with all of you. And Brian, let me start with you, because you're a Republican strategist. It appeared to many people that the Handel campaign had decided that a strategy they were using was to not have Karen Handel out in front of the media particularly often. There's been some concerns. I haven't seen this because I haven't been watching her day-to-day schedule, that she hasn't been doing as many public appearances. If they suddenly accept four debates, do you think it says something about they're looking at the polls and seeing that they have got to get back out there because this race could possibly be moving in Ossoff's favor? Or is that foolish speculation?
Yeah, I think the speculation was that she was avoiding debates, sort of having this front-runner strategy. You know, if you are 10 points or more ahead, something like that, it makes sense to not do a debate because only bad things can happen for you. You're not going to necessarily grow your lead, but you could definitely lose one with a really bad debate performance, with that soundbite that just stays with you and hangs around your neck for the remainder of the campaign. The fact is, for the month after the first round of the primary, Karen Handel was in a very different crouch than John Ossoff was. He had money pouring in from all over the place. She had a much less funded primary, first round campaign, mm-hmm. and she had to build from scratch. So she had to spend the first 4 weeks out there dialing for dollars and building up that war chest so that she could be competitive. And they have done that. This will be one of the highest fundraising races in the history of the entire United States of America. So I give her credit for that. And so now that they've got that first leg out, they can now take steps toward perhaps building a message that better defines Ossoff and makes this a choice as opposed to what it's been so far, where he can kind of be all things to all people, and begin to plot out how they're going to handle the media and these debates. So I think we assumed a lot of things that weren't true because the campaign went from being so high profile to disappearing for a period of time. She had to regroup. And I think now she is, and we're moving to the next phase.
But I think Bill is right in the fact that this was a sort of under-the-surface campaign for a little bit. I mean, we were reporters were bugging the campaign pretty much every day, and there were some things on the record about every day. But, you know, the public media advertised appearances for Karen Handel had been kind of few and far between, especially at the beginning. There was an event with the Chamber of Commerce right near right after she got that second place slot in the April 18th election. But other than that, there's only been a handful of, you know, media advisory type events. At the same time, she's tweeting a lot about her events, at her meetings, about speeches she has, things that we as reporters don't necessarily know about, things that aren't advertised on Facebook or through press releases, but that she's still going out there. And we know she has a packed schedule. It's just a lot harder for us to go and ask her questions about it at the.
So I think there are two things here that are important. What's always most important is interfacing with voters. And so that's my question as somebody who lives in the next district and, you know, doesn't necessarily get bombarded with this stuff except on television, was to what extent are both candidates actually out on doors talking to voters? That's way more important than I think some of these appearances are. But I think the most important thing to kind of think about is the media frame that gets created around a candidate. And so if you have a candidate who is not stepping forward and going to public events that can be covered, then all of a sudden the media narrative that reporters are going to write about is, where is this candidate? We haven't seen him or her. And I think that had become had begun to be a problem for Karen Handel, which is why we're seeing this shift. But this is a lot to do in a race that is really tight. And so I think it's a question of how many people are actually still persuadable who are going to turn out and vote in this election. And so, you know, we'll see in a couple weeks whether or not this is too little, too late.
And that's the fascinating part. Poll after poll has showed it, 3%, 4%, 5% undecided, which is remarkably low, but it also makes sense because $36 million has now been spent or reserved on this race, and that total is likely to exceed $40 million before this is all said and done. So there can be few excuses that people weren't paying attention or didn't know about the race, at least. So there's not that many persuadable, I think, but they're looking to get their core supporters revved up, and I think the debate, having some snackable videos, answers from each candidate, can do that.
I'd say one thing that, going back to your original question, Bill, on Karen Handel's strategy, if at any time they thought that just being the Republican was going to put them into the winner column on June the 20th, I give them credit for realizing that is not the case, that this is a fight. And she can't win it in absentia. She's got to win it in the ring. And that's what these four debates are, which is why they're going to be must-see TV in a way that I can hardly remember. And Greg, yeah. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong. I can't remember a time where we had a debate in Georgia that was must-see TV for a state race. And these are.
Yeah, the 2014 governor's debates, they were kind of ho-hum affairs. There was no anticipation. Awful. There was no excitement around them. They were kind of just sort of drills that we had to go through. This is very different.
Yeah. In 2014, I was doing the governor's communications and the reelect, and I said, if we sign up to do 10 debates the way we did in 2010 – consider this my resignation. I'm not doing it.
And the governor thought twice.
Because of that. I cannot win this without Brian Anderson.
That's right. I still think, Andra, at this stage, four debates is a lot of debates. And while I agree with what I'm hearing from Greg and Brian about, well, this is more exciting and must-see TV, I really don't know what the appetite is out there for four debates, and I'm not quite sure what a candidate gets out of four separate debates in this race. Maybe it is just the soundbite that they can push out on social media and in a TV ad, but it seems I'm not quite sure what's at stake for them with four debates with a month to go.
Well, I mean, I think the issue is if this were April 30th instead of May 31st, this would be a slightly different thing. But you're like, oh, man, this is like 3 weeks away.
Yeah.
Less than 3 weeks away at this point. And you're like, oh, wow, that's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot of debating.
Yeah.
And so, so I think for a lot of people, there will be fatigue. And then there's also the issue of summer. So people are just outside more. And so they're not necessarily going to be cooped up watching televised debates. They'll wait for the highlights on the news. And I think most people have probably made up their mind about who they support. This is just a question of GOTV.
So Greg Bluestein, it's a good thing you just went on vacation and are back.
Yeah.
Because with four debates coming up, you're going to be a very busy guy.
I told my wife that as of today, it'll be pretty much, you know, nonstop weekends and everything till the June 20th runoff. And remember, these four debates aren't it. There's some other big moments that we're going to have. We're going to have the fundraising deadlines. I think it's June 8th, so the numbers should come out either right before or right after that. We're going to have Mike Pence's visit. The AJC has a poll that will be coming out next week. Who knows what it'll say because it hasn't even gone to the field yet, but that'll come out at the end of next week. And I don't know, whatever, a million other things in between now and then, and national news that could, you know, help shape the race even more.
Okay, early voting started yesterday across the 6th. We have some, I think we've had 7,000-8,000 people who took ballots on this first day, went in and voted for the first time, but it's fairly early to try to figure out what those first votes tell us. The one thing we can say, Andra, is that, in fact, I just remember Mike Thurman, the CEO of DeKalb County now, was just in our building late this morning, and he and I talked for a little while. And I said to him, you know, Mike, and of course, Thurman is a Democrat. I said, you know, Mike, this isn't, you know, Democrats in DeKalb, it struck me, missed an opportunity before April 18th as they looked to try to propel Ossoff over the finish line without a runoff. They didn't open up a lot of early voting locations. They, for a good part of the early voting period, were only having voting going on down at Memorial Drive, not a convenient location for most people. So they probably missed some early votes. This time, they're ready. They've opened several more early voting locations, the kind of openings that they have before any election. Is that, in a Democratic county, going to help the Ossoff folks get their people out in DeKalb, and will that make a difference? If Fulton doesn't, North Fulton doesn't respond there, North Fulton's changing some of their polling places, so it's interesting.
So I was more concerned about hearing about the changes in polling sites for North Fulton County. Like, that strikes me as kind of fishy. And I don't think it's fair to anybody, regardless of what the partisanship of the district is, you know, especially when you have elections this close in proximity to one another. Like, just the more that you can keep things predictable, the better, because when stuff becomes unpredictable, then you discourage some people from voting. You know, but in general, you know, I'm of the attitude that you should try to make voting as easy for people as possible so that you can get people out to vote. And I think they're also anticipating for a special election that there's going to be a lot of high demand. Greg, please correct me if I'm wrong about this, but my understanding was that yesterday turnout was actually very robust in Cobb. So even if stuff gets more liberalized and more open in DeKalb County, that doesn't mean that in other more Republican parts of this district that you're not also going to see an uptick in turnout and interest in this race as well. So, I mean, you know, in general, I would tell all three counties, do what you can to get people to turn out to vote, because that's healthy for democracy.
Here's my strategy as a Republican in DeKalb, and I want other Republicans in DeKalb to follow this, is wait until we get offers of free rides from celebrities. and then, so have these Democrat celebrities come pick you up at your house and drive you all the, ask them to go to the furthest away precinct, like the one that's like in Decatur, which isn't even in the district, to eat up all of that time for these celebrities so they're not taking Democrats to the polls. That's my strategy. I'm just waiting on the right celebrity to come along and offer me a ride.
Greg, sounds like a story.
It does.
I mean, it sounds like he's suggesting something that's unethical.
is it, though? They're offering free rides.
All right, go ahead, Greg.
But, I mean, and by the way, the people offering free rides are saying it's a nonpartisan.
Yeah, they say it's nonpartisan, except that all of the organizations that are partnering with them
are
to be Democratic organizations, right? The union, some of the unions. Is the NAACP involved with them? Or, no, Stacey Abrams group. I mean,
it's fair to say these are left-leaning outreach efforts, but it also goes to show you that both sides are looking for literally every edge they can get, and that's why that court ruling allowing the voter registration to extend to May 21st was such a big deal, because we've already seen as of today 8,000 more people, not just through that, but 8,000 people overall get registered. Additional people get registered to vote for this runoff, and that could be the difference.
It really could be the difference. And I tell you what, if you are a Republican and you see those numbers, you should be concerned because it's just hard to imagine that there's that much energy on our side. You got to think that those are largely Democrat voters who have signed up. And if they went through the process of getting registered during this very small window, you know they've been educated on when that window is. So you know that they're engaged in a way that very few voters in a normal election are. So they're definitely going to show up. I'm very concerned by by those numbers. That's a huge number in a House race.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's debatable apart from additional education and mobilization. So I'm just going to go with sort of like the general kind of rule of thumb is that if you just register somebody to vote, there's a good chance they're not going to show up to vote. So like they tend to be sort of your lower propensity voters because they tend not to have the same type of knowledge about the system and knowledge about what's going on. So, you know, what I would say is for whoever registered these people to vote, make sure that you follow up with them and remind them of when Election Day is and what all of the procedures are. I mean, and especially this is why changing polling places from a first round to a second round is so dangerous, because these folks may know where that old polling place was, and they might be precisely the type of person who, if there isn't a sign that's telling them where to go vote, you know, the second time around, that they may just give up, or it's the end of lunch break and they've got to go back to work.
It is my understanding, I know you called it fishy, and for all we know it might be, but it is my understanding, these are Fulton County polling places, North Fulton County, and which is Republican territory, clearly. Greg, it's my understanding that this was, it's being explained as unavoidable. It's not like Fulton, well, let me just say it. It's being explained that these are locations in schools that need to close for renovation that they can't put off any longer. But Dr. Andra Gillespie is suspicious of that reasoning, and maybe she's right. I don't know.
Yeah, and this is, we've seen this come up before in general election cycles too, with things like holiday breaks and other issues there as well. And you're seeing it at early voting sites, not only in North Fulton, but also in DeKalb. And it has led to some voter confusion already. We've already received in just, what, a day and a half reports of people going to the wrong places. So it could maybe help depress some of the early voting turnout, but it's still really early.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, voter suppression, I mean, we think about it in partisan terms, but this is something that everybody should care about because it could affect anybody. And the idea that within a 6-week period, you move polling places when people aren't paying attention, there's, you know, and I understand that there are logistical reasons. So I don't know if it's you cordon off part of a school where like there isn't anything going on, have people vote in the principal's office or something. But yeah, I mean, like people should have thought about that. And given Fulton County's problems in elections, because it's not like this hasn't happened before around here, like this is something they should be especially vigilant
about.
Yeah,
I think that's a really good point. All right, look, we've got to get a break in. But before we do, let me remind you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB to be part of the conversation. You should be tweeting. You should look at our Twitter handle. You should follow us. We'd really appreciate your doing that. And you get to be part of the conversation if you do that. Also, we have our phone line that if you want to leave a comment on our telephone line, the number is 678-757-4472. 678-757-4472. Of course, you can call us and record a message about anything that is of interest to you in politics right now, but our producing team suggests that we ought to do this, and there's a reason for it, which we'll get to a little later. Trump, we know, sent a really bizarre tweet in the middle of last night. We'll talk about it briefly at some point today. So here's the general question, and it gets asked over and over, but we haven't asked you to give us your thoughts about it. What do you think about Trump tweeting from his personal account, whether you're a pro-Trump person, an anti-Trump person? What do you think about that? Maybe if you're an anti-Trump person, you can't get enough. You love it because you think every time he tweets, he's undermining his own cause. Maybe if you're a pro-Trump supporter, you think, why doesn't he stop doing that? Because he has more important things to do. So call and leave your message. Keep it brief. Give us your name and where you're calling from at 678-757-4472. We'll play some of those on an upcoming show. And today, we've got some of your phone calls from this past week, which we'll get to later in the show. Okay, it's Political Rewind. We'll be back in a minute.
It's time for spring cleaning. Donate your used car to GPB. Just call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate online at gpb.org/cars. That's 877-GPB-1-CAR or gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Brian Robinson, Andra Gillespie, Greg Bluestein with us today. By the way, of course, you read Greg Bluestein's byline in the AJC virtually every day, at least one story, if not three. And he files for the AJC's Political Insider blog. Let's just finish up a few other items on the 6th district race. Greg, you talked about the fact that we're looking at a potentially a $40 million plus race by the time it's over. Okay. So, and there's a huge push going on right now in both camps to get people to keep pouring money into their campaigns. All right. It's nuclear war.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to have a bigger nuclear arsenal than the, let their opponent have a bigger nuclear. Yeah. All right. But here's my, you know, maybe I should ask you this, Andre, because you're the academic here. And then you can weigh in. The question becomes, all right, the money is maybe going to have a, make a difference in who wins this race. Maybe. But what do you think it says to, what do you think it says to Americans, to us here in Georgia, about the amount of money that's gone into this? Aren't we all just disgusted with it? And are the long-term consequences somewhat troubling to you?
So I have offended some people by saying no to this question before.
Get ready.
And here is why. I mean, I think it's a problem if people are trying to use their money to buy influence in an election. But money signals to me just competitiveness. And so when you see fundraising go up, when that's more of a symbol of how competitive or how serious a candidate is. And when you see the type of fundraising that we've seen in this race, it is just an evidence of how close this race is. You know, we talk about and we decry the spending in presidential elections, and we can talk about and argue and debate the source of the funding. But, you know, it costs money to hire professionals to do a campaign well. It costs money to do ad buys. It costs money for campaign signs and hats and T-shirts and other kinds of things. So in perspective, we spend more. I've heard different figures that I use in the textbook that I teach with my students, that we spend more on potato chips, we spend more on pornography than we do on political campaigns. So, yeah, I know it seems obscene, but in the grand scheme of things, it actually isn't when we think about sort of like what our vast GDP is. And so that's a tough thing. And so what I'm more interested in is what people are doing in this race. Part of the reason why this race is getting so much attention and so much money is because of all of the special elections. It's the closest and most competitive. But this is also a time for incubation. And so what I hope both parties are doing is using this excess of resources to test new ways to reach out to voters, and then that they're collecting data so that they know after this what outreach methods work, which outreach methods don't work, and then potentially this could be used to good purposes in 2018 to scale up on a national scale. You know, if this were, even if this were a close race, this would get a lot of attention, but if this were, you know, in the grand universe of 435 races, we wouldn't be spending so much time on this, but we have time. And that's the reason why people are focusing on this. And people are still upset about November. So that's why they're focusing on this. Okay. But I would rather people use this money and just figure out good ways of targeted communications to people and then figure out how to use that next year.
I mean, I make my living in this. So, yeah. So I love to see tens of millions of dollars being spent in Georgia. And I can tell you who else loves it are the people who sell ads at Channel 2, Channel 5, Channel 11, and Channel 46.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's just been a bonanza for them, but also for many local radio stations. I mean, every slot everywhere is being bought up. It's great for our economy. And look, at some juncture, I think that it doesn't matter, that it reaches a level where it's just noise and people tune it out. A lot of the mail that I live in the district, a lot of the mail that I'm getting day in and day out is saying the same thing day in and day out. It's not really adding to the conversation. It's adding to the weight of a particular message. So I don't know how much if it's making a difference, but if the other side is doing it, we got to do it too.
You got to do it. That's what I'm saying. It's nuclear war.
And going to Audra's point about if this is one of 435, it would definitely be a much lower profile race. But most of those 435 in any given year are not competitive. Yeah. The fact that this is somewhat close, the fact that this is the seat of Tom Price, the HHS secretary, the fact that this is in one of the major media markets in the country where Fox News Channel and CNN and MSNBC all have bureaus, that make all of those things come together to make this the perfect storm.
All right. We want to move on to other topics, but Greg, you have a little bit of an update for us on this debate situation.
Yes. Well, Handel agrees to four debates, but Ossoff doesn't necessarily confirm those four. Ossoff had earlier challenged Handel to six debates. Handel now answers saying that it agrees to four debates. The specifics of which debates they will agree to is still up in the air. The only two that they've both confirmed are the June 6th WSB debate and a June 8th WABE debate.
WABE or WPBA, TV or radio?
Yeah. It's both. Okay. So I guess it'd be simulcast.
Okay. Okay. Greg, one last thing about the six, because this is, I think, an important story. Trump and the 6th District. You know, Karen Handel certainly embraced President Trump when he came down here and did a fundraiser on her behalf. But there was just a piece, you guys had it, and the New York Times, I think, wrote about it. There's some uneasiness about how far to go in embracing Trump among Republicans in the 6th District. And that raises questions about 2018, too.
Yeah, I mean, it starts and ends with how Republicans and Democrats in these fast-changing suburban districts will relate to Trump, because this is where Democrats think they can take back the House. It's not in the Rust Belt. It's not in districts in Ohio that have, you know, swung really heavily towards Republicans. It's these conservative-ish districts like the 6th that once were solidly Republican, that now Trump had only won by a point and a half. There's districts like that all over the country. Democrats need to flip 24 districts to take back the House, and they're looking at districts like the 6th, districts, suburban Orange County type districts in California and in New York, and these areas that they once couldn't compete in, and they'd focus on sort of blue collar working class districts instead. Now I think their pendulum is swinging back, and they think they can compete here.
Well, Gwinnett County with
the 7th.
Yeah, the 7th.
Rob Woodall.
That's, Rob should be fine. He really needs to get through the 2020 cycle where we can redraw the district and give him some more Republican voters in Forsyth or Walton or Hall County, because that district is going to go purple then blue eventually if left the way that it is. So those are, you know, and that Woodall district is showing up now very high on the target list of these Democrat organizations.
It's the 14th most trending Democratic district in the nation. And again, going back to our earlier discussion, that is partly the reason why so much money has been spent on this race. $21 million just on the runoff cycle. And that's astounding amount of money. And Democrats are outspending Republicans so far by about $11 million to $10 million.
All right. We will have plenty more to say about the 6th District race on shows to come, of course. But it's time to turn our attention to – we haven't been on the air live since last Wednesday. Friday we did a special edition of Political Rewind. We got great response from you all about our conversation with Tom Johnson of the Lyndon B. Johnson White House, and then, of course, President Ed of CNN. And then Monday, we took the whole day off. So, lots has happened since we were on the air live with you last week. Let's go to yesterday's press briefing to start out our White House news.
I think the president's tweets speak for themselves. I think the tweet speaks for itself. I don't think sometimes you don't have to read too much into it. He's simply stated a fact. The tweet speaks for itself. I'm moving on. I think what I just said speaks for itself.
Andrew Gillespie, Sean Spicer yesterday responding to a lot of talk about how the president doesn't stop tweeting. Overnight, we had a bizarre tweet, which we'll talk about in a second. Well, let's talk about it because it fits into this larger picture. And let me set it up. So since the president is back, we know that his trip to Saudi Arabia, many people gave him high marks for. He went on to Belgium, where Italy and Belgium, and in Belgium particularly, there reports that NATO allies were disappointed, upset with his refusal to really step up mm-hmm. on behalf of NATO. He lectured them. He has picked on Angela Merkel, tweeted about how Germany has a terribly unfair advantage over us. That was one of the tweets the other night. And yet today, the story that's getting so much attention is the fact that in the middle of the night last night, Trump tweeted, despite the negative press coverage, COFEFE, COVFEFE. And it stopped right there.
Yeah.
What did you, when you woke up and saw that this morning, and then he did bring it down at about 5 o'clock this morning. What's going on?
He fell asleep mid-tweet. I mean, I don't understand what was so hard about that.
Well, I don't know what the rest of that word is.
Breaking news. Yeah. I mean, it could have been people noted it was around the same time of the bombings in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, it was, yeah, he just got pulled away. So, yeah, it was weird. And you know, you're typing, you get distracted, you accidentally hit your return or your send button, and then it's kind of out there. I mean, it's somewhat odd. He usually doesn't tweet at midnight. So, the window is usually kind of like between 6 and 8:30 in the morning.
Sometimes 3 a.m., though.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, but I mean, that hasn't happened, you know, in a long period of time when I'm usually waiting for the time. Like, if I get up at 6 or 7, I don't check his Twitter. But at about 8:30, I expect that if there was going to be something interesting done for the day, it probably would have been done by then. I mean, you know, President Trump, I mean, you know, before he came back, they were floating the all of his lawyers were going to vet his tweets before he hit send on them. And people scoffed at that. And this week has now pretty much been evidence of the fact that he's just going to tweet and do whatever it is that he wants to do. You know, I find this undisciplined. I think those tweets are going to eventually get him into trouble in some way, shape, or
form. We've been saying that for 2 years now.
I know, but I mean, there's a certain unpresidential way that he's acting with these tweets. I just, you know, I personally am uncomfortable with him sort of, you know, taking, you know, foreign policy and diplomacy out on Twitter. Like, this just doesn't seem to be the right venue for it. You know, I understand why he would try to defend his son-in-law. But again, this raises all kinds of issues that you have to defend your son-in-law when a lot of people think that neither he nor his wife should be working in the White House. There are all these things that I think we need to kind of
Well, deal. And I think what that leads me into is a question I want to ask, because I do want to talk about the Jared Kushner story right as it's unfolding. But, Brian, this kind of is an extension of the conversation we had when Brooke Gladstone of On the Media was with us last week. We all picked up, including us on this show just now, on this bizarre tweet overnight. And it seems to me that it continues. The more that it is talked about by the mainstream media, the more for people who support Donald Trump, it suggests to them that we're just playing out to get him, right?
Yeah. I mean, he took it down and said, and then made what was a pretty funny joke about, hey, let's play a game on who can figure out what whatever it was, means. And that's funny. And if it was Obama, it'd be like, oh, he's just like us. Look how personable he is. He's telling jokes. He made a mistake. He is actually human. Who would have thought? And with Trump, absolutely everything that he does, everything, no matter how innocuous, no matter, you know, sometimes it's silly, but it's all through a scandal, ethical, legal prism. And not everything he does should be sent through that. And so here's the thing. This is almost playing to his advantage with his base voters and with the electorate at large. Is there's so much noise about him. Everything he does is pilloried. That when something serious happens, where perhaps he did err, where perhaps he did do something that was against the law, people are going to be like, eh, because they've just heard too much. They just tuned it all out. And, you know, I have criticized Donald Trump on this show and when he's done things that are unpresidential, when he said things that are factually inaccurate, when he said things that are mean. But not everything he does is evil. And Republican voters would respond to the media much better if there were stories out there about there's legitimacy to what Trump was saying about our NATO allies paying their fair share to pull the weight on defense. I agree with him. He is right. These are rich countries. Why are they sleeping under the blanket of freedom that we pay for?
So I think part of that, Brian, there are certainly many people out there who also believe that the United States is taking on too big a share of the burden. But Greg Bluestein, part of the criticism that the president came under was his choice in how to lecture our allies in a very public forum, very public setting, to essentially reprimand them rather than having the kind of personal, private conversations that could very well have led to a more productive outcome in terms of others paying more for their participation. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that was the bulk of the reaction, especially after he left, when European leaders felt unencumbered and kind of went full throttle in criticizing Trump and expressing hope that he would stick with the Paris Treaty. You saw France's new president not only kind of give Trump a very vigorous handshake and try to assert himself, but you also saw him asserting himself with Vladimir Putin. And I think that there's a sentiment from France and Germany's leaders that with a Trump in the White House, they're going to take the leading role in fostering a sort of Western cohesion that they think is lacking.
All right. Let me read you some of the tweets before we have to get another break in. Angela Ford tweets, I'm not disgusted by the money coming into this election in regard to the conversation we had about the 6th district race. I only hear the GOP whining about it. It's okay when situations are reversed. Sam Burnham says, millions of dollars spent to get a $174,000 a year job. More power to you, Sam. We have Dee, who tweets, hate Trump, love his tweets because they reveal the real person, unfiltered narcissism, grandiose lies, delusional idiocy. Dee has strong feelings about President Trump, clearly. And then we have others who have tweeted that his tweets are embarrassing. They're not smart or funny. Let's do this. Let's get another break out of the way. Let's come back and continue our conversation with Andra Gillespie, Brian Robinson, and Greg Bluestein on Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, David Sedaris. His new book, Theft by Finding, is a collection of his diary entries from 1977 to 2002. Entries about everything from picking fruit and cleaning houses for a living to going to art school, his life-changing broadcast of his Santaland Diaries on Morning Edition, getting sober, and the deaths of his mother and sister. Join us. Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
We're back on the air. We've all been talking about is that a tweet that you just saw from Nate Cohn of the New York Times? Is that right?
Yeah.
What's he say?
Well, he's saying that with the first Georgia 6 in-person early voting numbers coming in, that he thinks it's less interesting than the first round. And he expects the Republican number to shoot way up in this election because many set it out because there was a choice to make amongst Republicans that were all just as good to them, perhaps.
Yeah.
You know, there was a mishmash of people who were running on the same issues. And this time, they don't have to decide who to support. They've got a known enemy, someone who's not going to vote the way that they want. And he would say to judge GOP turnout by what happened in 2014 when we had David Perdue and Nathan Dill on the ballot, as opposed to what we saw in round one. So that's one outsider's take that I think is really
okay,
interesting
and
really good news for Republicans.
Yeah, and Nate Cohn, of course, a big data cruncher for the New York Times and stuff like this.
I'm going to have to sit and think about whether or not I would compare a congressional district runoff election to a Senate runoff election. I mean, that still strikes me as a little more apples and oranges. It might be Red Delicious and Granny Smith, but I'm not quite sure it's quite fair.
All right, here's what I want to do. We've been promoting our telephone line because we do want to hear what you have to say. Today, the question we're asking you to call in about is what you think about Trump tweeting. But last week, we asked you to tell us in general, how do you feel about the president and the kind of the battle with the FBI, with Jim Comey, with the intelligence services in general, and a number of other questions. We got some really interesting phone calls from you, and we want to play you just a sample of them right now.
Hello, my name is Liam Monroe. There needs to be a robust discussion about journalistic integrity, and I have been so sick and tired of how this profession has been basically just bastardized.
I really feel like sometimes that people talk about the Obama insurance, but the people that are talking about it don't have it.
I'm interested to know about the firing of James Comey. I don't understand, and I'm a lawyer, how somebody can have a 10-year term and can still be terminated at will by a president.
Calling from Roswell, Georgia, seems to me that the House of Representatives is completely out of touch because it's such a gerrymandered body.
I believe our president is playing a shell game, and the only people he's going to be protecting is the rich. That's all I have to say. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you listening to me.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening. Bye.
And thank you for calling us. You can call us and leave your thoughts at, let me get this, number 678-757-4472. Our newest staff member, Olivia Rheingold, edited that for us, and we welcome her. This is her first day on Political Rewind, having started with us on Tuesday. We're glad to have you on the team, Olivia. Okay. So, Greg Bluestein, a couple of stories have crossed the wires in the last hour, really. One of them said, CNN has reported that that a source is telling them that a former FBI director, James Comey, will indeed tell investigators that President Trump tried to talk him into dropping the Flynn investigation, this gets deeper and deeper.
It does. No more memos or background sources or anything that can't be proven. This will be a firsthand experience testimony that no one can kind of water down. It'll be him speaking, and it'll be a bank of cameras capturing it for us all to watch.
Yeah, we'll see. We still are waiting to hear when they're going to schedule Comey. He has said he wants to wait until he's had a chance to talk to Robert Mueller, who, of course, is heading the special inquiry. He's the special counsel on this to make sure of how he can speak about this without violating any confidentialities or in any way running afoul of the Mueller investigation. The other news, Andre, that's a little bit more iffy, I suppose, is the White House seems to be leaking to different news organizations that President Trump has finally decided he wants out of the Paris Climate Accord, despite the fact that the CEOs, the kind of people he typically listens to, major CEOs, including the CEO of Exxon, have said this climate accord works for them. It helps energize their pursuit of renewable energy sources, and they're urging him to stay in. But this seems to be, if it's true, this is a reassertion of that nationalist kind of insider Steve Bannon part of the Trump organization that wants to respond to the voters who cast their ballots for Trump, in part at least because he said he'd get out of Paris.
Right. And I think this raises a whole host of questions. So one, this goes back to last week. In Belgium with our NATO allies, who also urged him to stay in the climate accords. And then it raises, you know, other issues of, you know, what's his relationship with the Senate going to be like now that he's reversing course on something that they ratified? So, you know, I think that, you know, it's not going to play out sort of for dramatics in the same way as the Comey firing did. But, you know, in many ways, he fired Comey because he thought that this was a way for him to rally people around him, and he's kind of keeping a campaign pledge and other types of things, but he didn't factor in what the externalities were going to be as a result of that decision. And I think this is another decision that has lots of long-range consequences that I'm not quite sure his administration has completely thought through.
Anybody want to pick? All right, we'll see if that happens. It certainly will continue, as you point out, this estrangement between President Trump and our allies in Western Europe, certainly.
And so, as you noted, too, it's deeply divided his administration. Rex Tillerson is a supporter of the Paris Agreement. Ivanka Trump is a supporter of it. I think Jared Kushner is as well. And then the Steve Bannon wing of his administration is not. And three Republican senators have come out against it. 13 Republican House members have come out against pulling out of the Paris Agreement. So it's kind of divided the Republican caucus, too.
Brian, we're going to take just a minute for this one because I want to move on. But I want to get your thoughts on Jared Kushner. We are told now that the investigation of ties to Russia is zeroing in more and more on the president's son-in-law and whether or not he tried to open a back channel with Russian officials. And this thing is getting bigger and bigger. Andre just talked about Comey and the firing and the consequences that were unexpected. The New York Times reports that President Trump may be a little more uneasy about Kushner because he apparently was a major force in suggesting that if Comey were fired, it would be a good thing. Trump would get Democrats would be behind him because they hate him too. Is Kushner, how do you react to this news and what its implications are for the Trump administration?
Well, you know, we saw over the weekend the administration really come out and, you know, guns a-blazing in defense of it. And the underlying message is, of course, we were looking for alternative means of communicating with international leaders because we didn't trust the Obama administration. They thought, and perhaps the president still thinks, that Obama was listening in on his conversations and collecting megadata that included people high up in the Trump transition team. So I do think that was the atmosphere in which they were operating. I'm not sure that having that conversation with the Russian ambassador is in any way illegal or inappropriate. You know, people who've been in the intelligence community for many years who are now high up in the administration say that it was a perfectly fine thing to do. I think of all of the things that are swirling out there, this does not set off my scandal alarm.
What does right now? What does?
Well, you know, I
would
am...
Would anything?
Well, I in the last week have been concerned at the disparity between how he talks to dictatorial regimes versus how he talks to democratic regimes. Yeah. I've found that disheartening. Even though I agree with a lot of what he has said about NATO, I agree with some of his his message. But these are our long-term partners. These are people who share our commitment to the right to vote, to share our commitment to human rights, not only in our countries but in others. And there's a chumminess with people who, with Duterte in the Philippines, who has allowed extrajudicial killing, which is essentially lynchings, like what we used to have here. He with the Saudis, who don't allow women to even drive. Mm-hmm. You know, Al-Sisi in Egypt has been told he wasn't lectured, and he has gone on a week-long crackdown since that "I'm not going to lecture you" speech. So those are my concerns. And but you know, in Trump's defense, he's never pretended to be anything else. He's very consistent, and this is what he said he would be in the campaign, and people elected it. So it's hard to go, "Hey, you fooled us."
And I think it's also important to note that I think for a lot of rank and file Americans, they were actually weren't paying that much attention to what was going on last week. And so that, you know, sort of allows them to do that. But, you know, especially with respect to NATO, there's saying something and then there's the way that you go about saying it. And so I think it was the sort of impolitic way that President Trump made his comments, even though he was keeping a campaign promise. And then there was also the seeming lack of recognition of the fact that this discussion has come up before and that there had been steps that were being made to address this issue. And so you can't just kind of come in and assume that there isn't any like legwork that hadn't already been done by previous administrations and that you're supposed to build on that, that it's not necessarily you're going to kind of come in and do everything anew. So kind of getting back to Jared Kushner, here's the issue that I have with this. I mean, there's the issue of the timing of this. So trying to set up a shadow administration while the previous administration is still in power. But then there's also the issue of offering to go on the Russians' turf to have this back channel conversation. That's the part that I'm really having a hard time with, just from a strategic and a security standpoint. If you want to have a back channel conversation as an American, I would want it to be done on my country's terms. I wouldn't necessarily acquiesce or look like I was even submitting to another power, especially one that you have a tense relationship with. Like, that just seems to me to be not particularly strategic. Mm-hmm. And I think that that ties into Kushner's youth. I'm not saying he's not a smart guy. He, by all accounts, seems to be really bright and really intelligent, but has no governmental experience before this. These seem like the types of rookie mistakes that, you know, this is why people don't like nepotism.
We're going to watch that. Those stories are going to play out. Greg, I want to change. We have just a couple minutes left. Last Wednesday, I mentioned it earlier, we talked about what seems to be a growing war. That's not an unfair characterization, I think, between the Trump administration and the media these days. It's certainly perceived as a war out there. And after our show went off the air that night in Montana, the now congressman-elect, Gianforte, in fact, we keep using the term body slammed. What he did was he pushed down and, according to some reports, hit at least once Ben Jacobs, a reporter who was trying to ask him questions about the markup or the scoring on the health care bill.
Yeah, I mean, Ben Jacobs had confronted Greg Gianforte, who at the time was the candidate, now he's the House representative-elect, about an important question, which he hadn't answered yet, which is how you feel about the AHCA bill, how you feel about the healthcare overhaul. He had not answered those questions and was not given an interview, so he showed up, like many reporters do, unannounced, before he was going to interview a local Fox affiliate. And the audio of that was chilling.
Yeah.
I mean, it was pretty rough.
And we can even come closer to home. A number of news organizations, including Doug Richards over at Channel 11, reported on what seems like a minor incident, but unfortunately in the larger context, it's a little troubling. The sheriff, Scott Berry, over in Oconee County, which is out near Athens, put up on the Facebook page of the sheriff's office, to paraphrase Augustus McCrae, a character from Lonesome Dove, quote, "It ain't much of a crime whacking a surly reporter." And just a couple days before that, the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, went to a shooting range, showed what a great shot he was, and when he held up the target that showed him with all these bullseyes on the heart of the target, said, I'm going to carry this around in case I see any reporters. Okay, we all make bad and inappropriate jokes, but the climate that we talked about the other day is becoming more and more troubling, I think, to many people.
It is, and I think to some people at least. And my colleague Tamar Holloman was actually in Montana for the vote, and she heard people cheer him on, cheer Gianforte on, even when he apologized, saying, don't apologize, you don't need to apologize. And the fact that he won and his victory might have had nothing to do with the body slamming. It might have come in spite of it. There's lots of other factors at play, obviously, and the biggest one was more than half the electorate had already voted early. But it is seen by some, at least, as a validation of that kind of treatment, which is scary to us reporters.
Brian, when you were in the governor's office, you could be very tough on reporters. You could fight with them.
Never
when
to
you,
Greg, though.
When you wanted to protect your boss. But don't you worry a little bit about the environment that seems to be springing up?
You know what? I do think there are some parallels, and I would never compare being in the governor's office to being in the West Wing. There's obviously a huge scale difference there. But when I was most combative and meanest was when I felt we were being lied about and not given a fair shake. And I can go through historically and show on case by case where I really lost my mind, I was right. History has proven me right. And I was dealing with these storylines that were overwhelmingly negative, overwhelmingly biased. And over time, I was proven right. When those stories stopped, I got real nice. Some may even say I was pleasant to be around. And I think
a second-term victory doesn't hurt it either, though.
It's true. Yeah. You do care a lot less after that. But the I think, well, first of all, let's remember, I do think that I abhor violence. I abhor violence. It turns my stomach, and it is so bad for a civilized society. But let us not pretend that this is something that is gripping the right and gripping Trump supporters. No Republicans ever burned cars in D.C. when Democrats became president. And you look at what happened on the campus at Berkeley when they had controversial right-wing speakers. Those people are violent. What students have done at these commencement ceremonies has been an embarrassment to the country.
I got to interrupt you because what you did was you just opened up an entire show's worth of conversation that we can't even begin. Very smart to do that as we are completely out of time. I could see Andre Gillespie poised to respond. You are going to have to hold that, I'm afraid, Dr. Gillespie. Andre Gillespie, Greg Bluestein, Brian Robinson, thank you for being here today. Remember that you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. You can also listen to the show. Tell your friends at the Political Insider blog at AJC.com. It'll be posted shortly after the show goes off the air. And call us, 678-757-4472. Jenny, Tyler, Lisa, Olivia, thank you so much. Chastity, thank you all for your help in the control room today. We'll be back again on Friday at 3. Jim Galloway's back from a 2-week vacation. Talk to you then. We're